Welcome to the Ollie Podcast Series, presented by the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute and Penguin Radio at Dominican University of California. This series is created by the students of the Communications and Media Studies Department, where our chair is Mari Puleggi.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Penguin Radio, live on the air. Today, our guest is Mr. Vernon Dwelly, who is a very interesting man, and you, I'm sure, will feel the same way when you hear part of his story. We are going to pick up from 1941, when you wanted to be an RAF pilot, but couldn't get there, or could you? Please tell us about it.
No, didn't quite make it. Reason being that, you know, after the First World War, England basically disarmed up to a point, and Europe basically disarmed. The First World War was supposed to be the war that ends all wars and peace from here on eternally. Well, the world isn't made that way, unfortunately, but what happened is that England had to rearm at that time, and I think looking at the American scene and what happened in Europe, I'm eternally grateful to two people. They're icons for me. One of them is Winston Churchill, who I think won the Second World War single-handedly by being the main voice that opposed Hitler, and Franklin Roosevelt, who created the Lend-Lease and other programs in order to help England and Europe survive. So these are two of my icons in life.
When were you born?
1921.
And when did you develop this interest in flying?
Oh. Well, some kids want to be fire engine drivers, you know.
Yeah.
And others want to fly planes.
Yes.
And somehow along the line, when you have to think about a war, unfortunately, and you have to think about what you want to be tied into, fighter pilots sounded very romantic and very interesting.
Yeah.
No more than that.
Did you get to become one?
No, never did, never did.
So it was just something you wanted to do?
Yes. But instead of that, I signed up for the special services, which was also, to some extent, a creation of Winston Churchill, because he wanted mobile type of units where individuals could take action in terms of intelligence, in terms of a variety of things that need to be done in a war. And so the commandos were a unit that, I don't know if you want me to talk a little about that now. Okay, fine. Commandos, this particular commando was a number 10 commando international. And we had troops, you know, you all know that Germany was invading the European countries and taking over Belgium and Holland and France and wanted to take over England as well, but never made that landing. And so all these countries created, any of you know Charles de Gaulle? Have you heard of him? He was the Free French leader of France. And these countries developed small units to fight Hitler on our side. In other words, they couldn't do it in Europe because their countries had been taken over. So they did that in England, and some were sent to America as well. And so our special services commando consisted of a number of a Dutch troop, a French troop, Portuguese troop, a Norwegian troop, etc., etc. And so it was an extremely interesting unit to which I was then assigned after some very severe training. Well, what happened was that I was involved. My first contact with Americans actually was in England, where we trained a company of American Rangers in night warfare. You go on a submarine, and a dinghy lets you out, and you go on land, and you do intelligence work and that type of thing. Mm. So we trained them in that type of activity.
Paratroopers?
Yes.
Did you have any night jumps?
Night jump, day jumps. get funny situations. When I heard about this program, about my being interviewed here, I put down a few things that are sort of a little bit funny. And one of them was I had a fellow in my unit by the name of Latimer. Never forget it. It was a Czech. And we parachuted. And in order to have total anonymity, you parachute at the darkest night possible when the moon is nowhere and some clouds are up there. And so Latimer jumped, and he ended up in a big tree. And we were not permitted to shout or call or show lights or anything else. It's the whole thing is a big mystery. And so Latimer, if this is the tree, right? Latimer was somewhere down here, but he thought he was somewhere up there and got in a tremendous panic. And we had to eke him out of there finally, you know.
Without saying anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Just about. Well, eventually we said.
Yeah.
Relatively low altitudes.
Such as? 5,000 feet?
Less than that.
Wow.
Even. Yeah. And so you had a matter of seconds, really, to get your act together. And we were attached. We went out of planes where the parachute was attached to a beam in the plane. So we did not activate it ourselves. Later on we did that, but it releases automatically, you know?
Yeah.
And
based on how high you are.
Yes, yes.
I see.
And you had to be careful in some cases. There were a couple of aircraft that we jumped out of where you go out of the bottom part of the plane, and it's a chute, and you have to keep your chin up because otherwise you hit your chin. And yeah. I mean, there are funny little aspects to all this.
You don't want to get knocked out as you're going out of the plane.
It's unpleasant. I mean, you're doing the enemy's work, right?
Right, that's exactly right. And that also speaks to building those parachutes that drop quickly because they're harder to hit as targets.
Very much so, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. An interesting aspect, by the way, that they might enjoy is that the parachutes, let's say we had a team of 15 parachutists selecting parachutes. They're all on a rack somewhere, and we selected our own. And we never accepted a parachute from an employee of the Army or Air Force. And the idea was that they could have a vendetta or a personal reason why they want to obliviate you, you know.
Yeah, put the wrong fold.
This is not invented. I mean, this is just the precaution that no human hand can interfere. And unfortunately, my very first jump delayed me quite a bit because we had, you know how a canopy looks of a parachute? I had what is called a thrown line, which meant that the parachute was not quite correctly packed and goes down even faster, mm-hmm. and you have no control for the landing. And so I bust my knee a little bit. Nothing too bad.
On your very first jump?
Very first jump, yes.
So that made, when you came to your second jump, you may have been more reluctant, having broken your knee in your first jump.
Yes, but they make you do the second jump to get you over the hump.
Yeah, right, right. Did Lattimore have a lot of experience before he landed in the tree?
I don't know how many jumps he had. I mean, we had a very substantial number of jumps.
100?
30, 40,
oh,
50,
okay.
60, some had more. And it's very exciting. I recommended it at the time as part of the training for Boy Scouts because it gives you an enormous amount of self-confidence. You know, if you float through the air and all you hear is shh, nothing else. On the higher jumps, you get more of that, lower jumps.
I jumped once from 11,000 feet. It was on my birthday. But it was not at night, and it was not under the duress of war. It was not on a parachute that's designed to drop very quickly, and nobody was shooting at me when I did it. Even that was exhilarating, as you say.
Yes.
I retired that afternoon, though. That was enough. One time was enough. 30 or 40 jumps, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Especially at night.
And actually, the for some of us, and I'm included in that, I think the fear factor jumping increases as you go.
Isn't that interesting?
You somehow sort of feel that, well, I've been lucky for 30 jumps. I don't know about 31.
I'm reluctant to ask, so it's up to you if you want to talk about it, but what about, did you see action?
Oh, yes.
Do you mind talking about that, or is...
No.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I mean, writing this book, we get some help from a couple of mentors who help you lay it out and design the cover and tell you what print to use, what paper to use, and that sort of thing. They're wonderful people. And one of them persuaded me. I never talked about the war. I'm one of these people that, I don't know where you fit in, but negative things I don't like to talk about. And war is negative, no matter which way you look at it. And so this mentor persuaded me to include wartime stories. And I'm working on book number 2 at the moment, and there will be a number of wartime stories in it. So I think that, let me give you an example. D-Day. I miss D-Day. And I nearly cried over it. And the reason was that I was chosen. There were 11 of us. And I was chosen to participate in a parachute landing. We had, at that time, missiles like we know them today in North Korea and God knows what. I mean, didn't exist at all. But England at that time, in conjunction with other countries, developed two missiles of sorts. The one was a buzz bomb. Have you ever heard of it?
Of course.
When the motor cuts out, it comes down. So if you're not there, fine. The second one was a Werner von Braun, who worked for the German Air Force and created the first missiles for Hitler.
Was this the V-2?
Yes. And so the mission that we had, the 11 of us, was that we would be dropped on D-Day behind our lines, and we had very little knowledge. We had lots of knowledge on V-1s, but very little knowledge on the V-2. And a battery of V-2s, we were to investigate and send messages back. Now, at that time, we didn't have iPhones, we didn't have any of this modern technology. We had what is called an S-set. And the S-set is a radio which only transmit in one direction, maybe this way or that way, so the enemy cannot easily intercept it. Well, we would have planes flying over us, and the message would go up to them. Well, to cut long story short, we're up in Scotland, a very remote area, knew somewhat pretty closely what the date of the invasion would be, because we couldn't get anywhere from there, so they trusted us. What happened that day is the RAF, the Royal Air Force, accidentally bombed our target, with the result that the whole operation was cancelled. And we sort of started crying. We were so keyed up to this thing that we really wanted it. And the only thing I can tell you useful people around here is that if the operation had taken place, the chances are, I don't know what the percentage is, that I wouldn't be talking to
you
today.
That's right.
But when you're young, you don't think of that aspect, really. I mean, it escapes you.
Especially as you think back. This must be hard to even imagine that you were so keyed up for this event that was likely going to kill you.
Yeah.
And yet your feeling of responsibility to get in there, figure out what was new about the V-2, what made it different, relay that information back behind enemy lines.
Yeah,
that is really, it's contrary to staying alive and to all things behind enemy lines.
It was pretty close to the end of the war, 1945. We needed to clear the port of Antwerp, which is the port of Belgium. And the reason was for the Allied armies and navies to be able to get in and logistically deliver foods and ammunitions and everything else. I mean, it's right at the end of the war. And so the mission that I was assigned to with a small group of people that I was in charge of was to help in that clearance by attacking an island called Walcheren. I won't remember that. And the island was supposed to be bombed by the Air Force so that water would go into the dikes of the islands and would kill the guns that were surrounding the entire rim of the island. And the weather was so bad, the Air Force couldn't operate. So the guns were still there. And that was at the time when Hitler was using these, what they call the scorched earth policy, where every young guy, every old guy, everything was sacrificed in order to still have a chance to. And if they don't survive, then let it all be destroyed. I mean, that was the concept at that time. And we landed and had a landing craft. There were ammunition boxes in the landing craft. And I took what I called the officer's privilege and sat on two ammunition boxes, which is probably the most stupid thing anybody can ever do. In that landing craft. And the reason for that was that there was a lot of water in the landing craft, and I didn't want my feet dangling in that water. Well, what happened is that when we landed at Walcheren, our landing craft was blown up. And the ammunition boxes, believe it or not, saved my life, because they took off, did not explode, and I ended up in the water.
How could they not explode?
They didn't. It was just boxes of ammunition, and somehow they carried me into the air and dropped me in the water. I got pneumonia as a result of it later on, but that's the way it happened.
You would take pneumonia under the yes, under the circumstances, considering the alternative.
Yes.
Wow.
So and it was amazing. I mean, this is the scorched earth policy that I mentioned to you was that they had young kids from schools that were handling these guns, or were the Russians at that time, after the war ended, were penetrating the Western democracies, be that West Germany, be that Holland, be that France, and so on, with potential spies and cells. And we have all this happening today with ICs and cells being formed and so on.
I want to ask you about your book, Until the Gods Say No, which, hearing these stories of your youth and your days in World War II and all of the things that you went through, then to read your book of poetry, which Catherine Henderson has let me borrow her copy, it's so different. It's so not what you've just described as your life then, and more representative, I suspect, of your life now. It's so sensitive and has so much meaning to it. I'd like to read one that struck me, if it's okay.
Please do.
This is entitled Tomorrow. I look into the mirror and see the present. That slight smile is tomorrow. Blue skies predicted we will hike into the wetlands of our swans. Yet today, cloudy skies, payments due, library book due, all the pressures of today become simple routines in the glow of that beautiful tomorrow. Same guy who was jumping out of the planes and working as a spy against the Russians for Churchill. How is it that you're inspired for this kind of beautiful poetry?
I've always liked nature. And you remember saying, when I said a few minutes ago that when something negative happens in my life, and I've had some very negative periods as well, I cut them off and get on with something new. And that new, I think, is much more me than the war. That's the only answer I can give you.
How are you able to compartmentalize like that? That seems like it would be easier said than done.
I think it happens. You know, people ask me how do I get to an advanced age like I'm in, and I one of the answers I give is that I've always had and I always appreciate in others a positive attitude, a creative attitude, and I think that fundamentally I have more of that than jumping out of a parachute.
At least at this stage of your life.
That's right.
Right? Because back then, that's all that mattered at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
Is your book available? Where could people get it if they wanted it?
On Amazon.
It's called Until the Gods Say No by Vernon Dwelly. If you were to give us a parting statement based on your life from 1921 to now, what would that be?
Basically, life is wonderful, but you have to see the little flower in the cement. You've got to see the clouds in the sky. You have to somehow have that feeling of the beauty of nature, the beauty of life, and somehow do your bit to stop humanity taking the wrong course and the wrong direction. Do your little bit. We can't solve it all, and get on with. I have since retirement. I've done quite a bit of wood sculpting, driftwood sculpting. I've done some writing. I have a couple of inventions that I created. I've always got on with something that kept me going and kept me enthused. I think that type of thing contributes to a long life and a happy life. And I'm sure that Kathy Henderson does such a wonderful job with Ollie and with lifelong learning and so on, and we love her classes. And that is part of, I mean, Ollie today is a necessary part of my retired life. I don't know if this answers it at all.
It's perfect.
I mean, there are many aspects to it, but I think this fundamentally, I don't like ever to have negative people around me. I run away. And there are people that just live on negativity.
And you surround yourself with positive people like the Ollie folks.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful for Kathy and for you and the Ollie Group to have helped us put this whole thing together, because this has really been a beautiful few minutes with you, and I really appreciate your time.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
The book is yours.
May I have it?
Yes.
Thank you very much. All right, everybody. That's Vernon Dwelly right here on Penguin Radio.
Thank you for listening to today's installment of the Ollie podcast series, brought to you by Penguin Radio at Dominican University of California.